I think you can see that Agnieszka's got a very big vision and but been incredibly focused on getting all of that detail and all those stories that have come directly out of the papers. I've seen her every day for about 10 hours in that room in the Special Collections reading room, pouring through box after box after box to create this story, which probably has never been quite told in this way before. So with that, I think, and we are very fortunate to have a volunteer who I did not quite realise when I said you were the oldest volunteer in the room, Jeff, that you were actually there. So I think you've got your hand. Is there somebody else here too? Ah, how wonderful. Welcome to you, and I'm sorry I didn't meet you first. Perhaps we should give you the microphone to start with to ask and give you the first right of asking or commenting on anything that Agnieszka has to say. We ask you for the microphone simply because we are podcasting the talk and that way we can get the questions. So it's not for hearing, it's for recording. Thank you. So,
well, firstly, congratulations. I thought that was a masterly presentation about a subject. I'm glad to see a number of people want to know about and care about. In particular, I was appreciative of the remarks about the earlier days of the scheme when I was there and Lindsay before me. But in particular, the way in which you developed the theme of how the scheme changed and the way in which the role of government also changed in relation to the scheme and how notions of foreign aid developed after that and subsumed the scheme. But nevertheless, volunteers continue to go from Australia and from other countries around the world to what we think of as less developed. And that aspect of activity is really to be distinguished and added to foreign aid. And I think it's a very, very important point, and I thought you made it very well, if I may say so.
Thank you so very much. That's obviously a historian's worst nightmare to have this subject speak back, so thank you. that's brilliant. And I think that, yeah, absolutely. Of course. It is absolutely right, and there's something, you know, the element which I couldn't really add to tonight's presentation because there's just so much that I wanted to talk about is that relationship to aid. And Jeff makes a really good point. You know, this is coming to be at the same time, I mean, within a matter of months, as the most experimental of the UN foreign aid schemes towards development in the, you know, what came to be known as the Third World. So 1951, the same year that Herb Feith goes, is the year that the UN sends its first sort of development experts who are paid at a much greater salary. The Colombo Plan, of course, comes into being at the same time. And there's an immediate tension there. You know, the volunteers are talking back. They're saying, actually, you're doing it wrong. Before, you know, and sort of trying to intervene at a time when this huge system, which later becomes a behemoth, especially during the 60s, which was the decade of development, comes into being. So there's a real tension in a conversation, I think, you know, the critique of aid, but also how it fed into aid systems that could be had. And one day I will unpick it further.
Other comments?
There are two other volunteer graduates here, Lindsay and Sylvia Cleland, and also Patrick Anderson, who went as an AV, was AVA for a year in Indonesia. There are spies here. I was chairman of the volunteer graduate scheme from 1951 to 1962.
Don Anderson?
Don Anderson's my name.
Wow.
And congratulations, that was a superb presentation, and I think you've captured the essence and spirit of the scheme, and you've raised questions that some of us hadn't really thought much about, but are important questions. Politically, from the beginning, the scheme had people within the Australian government, had the ear of people. Alf Parsons, later become ambassador, was in the embassy when I visited Indonesia with Herb in 51, and he was a great supporter of the scheme. The committee, which you referred to, was a committee which I chaired, was mainly volunteer graduates, but Jim Webb, whom you mentioned, was a critical figure.
Mm.
And without Jim's drive, energy, organising ability, the scheme wouldn't have been the success it was, and the successor, the AVA and so forth, which Jim, of course, continued working there. The comparison with Peace Corps is interesting and probably instructive to follow that one up. I visited the Peace Corps people in America late 50s, and we compared notes, and I said, how do you select your volunteers? And they said, we've got a computer program, computers, you know, the size of a house then, but they had all of the attributes that were acquired in the field, and they matched those with personality characteristics and sorted them that way. They said to me, how do you select your people? And I said, well, they have to be able to withstand frustration and maintain a hard and frustrating task. And those were the frustrations were the volunteers inevitably have to wait. I'm sure Jeff and Lindsay and Sylvia will confirm this, but there were delays and difficulties getting posts. But the graduates, those there in the field, by the way, were important in attempting to get places for the others.
Mm.
And the hard task was learning Indonesian, and perhaps learning about Indonesian food and chili. But we found that anyone who stood the distance on those things were admirable guarantees, and we had no need of personality tests.
Thank you, Dawn. I'll have to have a chat with you afterwards. I've attempted to stalk you, but unsuccessfully in the past. I think you're absolutely right. Firstly, about Jim Webb. So when Robin says that I spend hours and hours reading the records, they're largely Jim's papers. The man was an inspirational and sometimes frustratingly thorough administrator. He got absolutely everything on paper, and it was just incredible. So reading those papers is fantastic. And as you say, I think that difference with the Peace Corps is very instructive. You know, the idea, the sort of the germ of the model that comes from Australia is picked up, but it's infused with such American qualities by the time it becomes the Peace Corps. And this is something I want to look at in that broader project. You point out computers, but there was a psychology industry that was going into this. I mean, this is the same time as the rise of psychology and social science as part of everyday life. So they were doing psychological testing of every single volunteer who got beyond an interview. Also publicity. So the advertising industries and publicity industries, which America does so well and unfortunately better than VGS did with its lovely typewritten newsletters, by the time the Peace Corps get their hands and budgets on it, it becomes, you know, there's sitcoms which feature the Peace Corps. There are so many ads in so many magazines using professional advertising agencies that it takes on a life of its own. Not necessarily to the benefit of the idea itself, though, because if you look at what they're talking about and what the advertising is, it's not about the job, it's not about the role, it's about the person and how great they are that they're volunteers, and aren't they glamorous and aren't they good looking, you know, these sort of selfless Americans who are the best of what America is. So, yes, I think you're very right. There is a huge difference between this scheme and what becomes the Peace Corps. But I'd be very interested in that chat that you had, which one day we'll follow up.
Yes, a little about the contemporary.
Hi, Paul Bird. I'm honoured to be the current head of Australian Volunteers International, and it's brilliant to be in such esteemed company. And Don, absolutely, I've been stalking you too. So you're not going to escape this room for very long. I just wanted to say, well done. It's fascinating, and it really builds on Gemma's book.
Yeah.
And look forward to working with you about our archives and actually, you know, supporting your work. My only observation is I think the approach around development and to some extent diplomacy is as relevant today as it was back then. I've had the last 30 years working in the developing world. I've found those communities happier most of the time and have more purpose and tradition than our communities. And my frustration is that we live in Australia, ever becoming more insular, more consumerist, and I'm desperate to enable more Australians to experience that, a world which I think has more purpose, but also to play a meaningful role in that. So my other frustration is, having worked in the development field, is that, including as a technical consultant, I've got to say, but working with NGOs, is I think the building of that mutual respect and trust which you talked about over a period of time with communities over a long period of time, and AVI, as you've alluded to, has been working in those communities for the last 50, 60 years, including the Pacific, around the Pacific for the last 50 years, that change is incremental. So the question for me is, how do we take those lessons? My job is to make sure that DNA still flows through AVI, which is really important, but how do we influence the government and the developed world that is the approach to development that should continue and should build?
Yes, it's not a question I can answer, I'm afraid, but thank you. It isn't a really important point that you're making, that this is still a continued relevance, and I think perhaps becomes increasingly so as the voluntourism industry rises up as a sort of competitor to development volunteering as it's, you know, officially set up. So if long-term projects and long-term contact with communities is, as you're saying, so important, then what happens when there's a sort of a shadow industry that sends kids for a couple of weeks sometimes, you know, to do jobs that they're not trained in and that locals would probably be better off doing and being paid for? So yes, I think you're exactly right. I mean, there is so much more here in terms of the politics of this. I'm not exactly sure that I can fix it, but I think that looking back at the history is an important thing that hasn't necessarily been looked at. You know, a lot of the debates in development studies are, does it work, does it not? You know, what are the benefits? Well, if you can sort of take it back a step and look at how did it come to be, you can sort of step outside of the Manichaean sort of divides, good, bad, and sort of see, well, the reason why it's complex is because it has conflicting sometimes elements that went into it at its very creation. So unpicking some of those threads and seeing that it was complex from the beginning can sort of help people understand why it's still complex and why, you know, it has mixed effects. But I think it's quite important to do that in the first place, as opposed to just, yeah, debating good, bad, fund or not fund.
I think we're drawing to a close. Is there anybody? Yes, one more? Any more comments?
Thanks very much. My name's Patrick Anderson. Don's son. I was a volunteer for 6 years, but four of them funded by the Australian Volunteer Program in Jakarta. I worked with Walhi, with Friends of the Earth Indonesia. And I think it's an interesting topic that goes beyond where you've gone, but how the framework of the volunteer program moved from support to government to support for universities and non-government organizations. And so my work was all, you know, with non-government groups, often criticising or opposing the Indonesian government. I knew Herb from when I was a kid, and I wasn't aware of his Christian values in that sense. I thought that they were more from his experience as a refugee and from a Jewish family. And I thought, and assumed, I suppose, that his approach was more framed around those more general human rights about, you know, the problem with totalitarianism and, you know, basic human rights of, you know, the right to exist as a people, the right to be able to speak, to be able to organise and so on. And that's very much how my work is. I work today with a group called Forest Peoples Program that works with forest peoples throughout the world, and it's basically, you know, it's a human rights organisation. So, but in the context of Indonesia and my work, I worked with an environment group. But in Indonesia, in the, you know, this is from 2001 till 2006 with Friends of the Earth Indonesia, there wasn't really a difference between environment issues and human rights issues. We had common enemies, which were, you know, the corruption, collusion, nepotism between government and industry, and the, you know, the abuse of the rights of communities and so on. But I think that's an interesting issue which probably goes beyond your study of where the program evolved and how it actually evolved into a program that doesn't so much actually provide placements in government, but more in the non-government sector. Thank you.
Thank you. No, that is actually a really good point. And I suspect, although I haven't done the study of it in sort of detail yet, that it's part of that broader shift in aid funding, which happens in the 70s and 80s as a lot of the really big funders sort of lose legitimacy. The World Bank, for example, stops being seen as right, and INGOs sort of step into that space. That work's largely been done in the UK context, so there is a little bit about, you know, how UK NGOs stepped in and gained legitimacy. So I suspect it's part of that. I think I do want to say something about Herb Feith, though, and that religious question, because that is a huge and quite interesting one. And I know Gemma Purdy, who's Herb Feith's biographer, and I've had this conversation with her actually in Indonesia. And she, you know, I was telling her, well, I've found all these things in Herb Feith's papers. It's actually evangelical. You know, it sounds like he wants to send missionaries to Indonesia. At this stage, he's very strongly Christian. And Gemma's like, you know, looking from the longer perspective of Herb over his life, she was just like, Agnieszka, he's not an evangelical Christian. Like, he doesn't have those strong beliefs. He went through many phases where he really believed lots of things at different times. You know, he's always a spiritual person who's searching for things. But, you know, she will say, I don't think he's an evangelical Christian. And I don't think he is, except perhaps at this point in time, you know, a couple of years in the early 50s, which happened to be so productive for him. But he was very clearly on some level influenced by these schemes. It's there, it's in his handwriting. So I think you're right. I mean, over a lifetime, if you look at Herb, he's not trying to push religion on anyone. It's very much a private journey, which is always imbued with those ideas of social justice. You know, it's never a nasty Christianity or nasty anything. But I think at this point in time, which is why I think it's so important to sort of make it a small story, he's very strongly influenced. So, yeah, I don't know what to make of that. It's an interesting debate.
Well, Agnieszka, I think you've taken us from the very small to the very big and back to the finishing small but very important point. And I think what you've also done is engender such living history, I would call it, as part of this conversation. And it is a conversation that's obviously very resonant in today's world as much as it was in the beginning of the 1950s. And I too think we would all concur with the comments that have been made that this was an exceptionally wonderful talk and a fantastic piece of research. We look forward to the very big book, but we also look forward to the individual stories that come out of it. So will you please join me in thanking Agnieszka.